Many of the world's most prolonged and heinous injustices have historically gone on unchallenged because they were concealed from public view. Only when a professional journalist was able to bring the injustice into public view was the injustice stopped. We think of US forces freeing Nazi prisoners in the Buchenwald and Dachau concentration camps that shocked not just Americans, but the world when accompanying journalists reported on what they saw. One wonders whether America would have entered the war earlier if they'd seen such brutal photos earlier. Who can forget the 1972 Associated Press photographer Nick Utz photo of Kim Phuc fleeing naked across a Vietnamese bridge? When the 1973 Pulitzer Committee awarded Nick its prize, it signalled the end of America's involvement in the Vietnam War. These samples illustrate why a free press is essential to the execution of proper justice and just how powerful images are. One of the last truly investigative journalism endeavours was done by the Spotlight team of the Boston Globe, the oldest continuously operating newspaper investigative journalist unit in the United States. A team of journalists spent 18 months investigating a major cover-up of child sexual abuse. When they began publishing their exposés over a series of weeks, the ramifications were felt around the world for the next 16 years. Their work earned the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service. Their investigation brought public awareness of the issue of institutional child sexual abuse, but this was markedly broadened by the 2015 Hollywood movie Spotlight, directed by Tom McCarthy, which was made about their investigation. Spotlight won the 2016 Academy Award for Best Picture and introduced the horrific story they uncovered to a global audience. Their work has reminded us all of just how important truth-telling is for effecting justice, despite the enormous institutional opposition and resistance encountered. The work of the Spotlight team illustrates the power of literary journalism to expose evil and injustice. The movie depiction of their investigation reenacted the pain, devastation, and even deaths which resulted from this evil and conveyed this in a way that only images could. But uncovering evil and injustice has not been the exclusive domain of professional journalists and photographers. From the late 1800s, King Leopold II of Belgium was conducting a reign of terror across the African nation of Congo as he brutally sought to exploit its natural wealth of rubber, minerals and ivory. His unchecked atrocities came to an end when an English missionary, Alice Seeley Harris, who was a pioneer photographer, began to document the Belgian king's atrocities with a series of graphic photos. After the Berlin Conference of 1884, the 905,000 square miles of the Belgian Congo, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, became the personal property of King Leopold II of Belgium. His genocidal exploitation of the territory, particularly the rubber trade, caused many deaths and much suffering, murder, and mutilation were common. King Leopold II of Belgium ordered the mutilation of any of the Congolese who did not meet their quotas of rubber or ivory. Congolese men who failed to meet the quotas had their hands chopped off as an example to other villagers to work harder. The Belgian soldiers then forced women into their forced labour, and they too became victims of limb mutilation. The soldiers then forced children, as young as five, into these labour camps. The atrocities and mutilations carried out by the Belgian soldiers was conducted without the world even knowing until Alice Harris, a Christian missionary to the Congo, took the now famous photo of a father looking at the severed hands and feet of his now dead five-year-old daughter. Alice began to campaign against the appalling human rights abuses being committed against the Congolese. Her earlier graphic photos of mutilations began to be published in 1902 in their missions magazine, Regions Beyond. That same year, Alice with her husband John returned temporarily to England. Her photos were made into magic lantern glass slides, which enabled them to deliver multimedia public lectures in colour, drawing people's attention to rampant injustice being perpetrated against the Congolese. In 1904, her photos were published in a pamphlet, Congo Slavery. In 1906, Alice and John toured the United States, conducting 200 meetings in 49 cities, where they screened their magic lantern presentation. In December of that year, the daily morning newspaper, the New York American, published Alice photos every day for a week, along with articles about the atrocities being committed in Congo. Within 2 years of this, King Leopold II relinquished control of the Congo Free State to the Belgian government. It is estimated that at King Leopold II's direction, 10 million Congolese had been murdered in addition to those who had been mutilated. The Belgians eventually granted Congo their independence in 1959. Nick Utt's photo, Tom McCarthy's movie, and Alice Harris's photos illustrate the effectiveness of giving the public a visual vocabulary. This does not ignore the power of the written word and the effect it has had historically in correcting injustices. It is possible for words to also add to our visual vocabulary, especially when these words are poetic or, more powerful still, set to music and sung. Interestingly, some of the most powerful songs about injustice have been inspired by a photograph. On August 7th, 1930, two innocent young black men, Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith, were lynched by a mob in Marion, Indiana. A photograph was taken of the gruesome event, which showed the hundreds of people who came out to witness the event exhibiting a carnival-like glee. Sometime later, a teacher in New York named Abel Mirapol came across the photo taken at this event and was appalled. He wanted to do something as a protest to this barbaric vigilantism. He penned a poem called Bitter Fruit, using the pseudonym Lewis Allen, and published it in the New York Teacher. He then set the poem to music and called it Strange Fruit. A black singer, Billie Holiday, heard Mirapol, his wife, and a black vocalist, Laura Duncan, perform Strange Fruit at Madison Square Garden. She was a regular performer at an integrated nightclub in New York called Cafe Society and asked the owner for permission to perform the song as a closing item each night. Because of the power of the song, Josephson, the nightclub owner, drew up some rules. Holiday would close with it, the waiters would stop all service in advance, the room would be in darkness except for a spotlight on Holiday's face, and there would be no encore. During the musical introduction, Holiday stood with her eyes closed as if she were evoking a prayer. Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the root.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Strange fruit hanging from poplar trees.
From the poplar trees.
Pastoral scene of the gallant South.
Pastoral scene of the gallant South.
The bulging eyes and the twisted mouth.
Bulging eyes and the twisted mouth.
Scent of magnolias, sweet and fresh. Then the sudden smell of burning flesh.
Sudden smell of burning flesh.
Here is fruit for the crows to pluck.
For the crows to pluck.
For the rain to gather.
For the rain to gather.
For the wind to suck.
For the wind to suck.
For the sun to rot.
For the sun to rot.
For the trees to drop.
For the tree to
Here is a strange and bitter crop. Billie Holiday recorded this song in 1939 with Commodore Records. It sold 1 million copies. In 1999, Time magazine awarded Strange Fruit the song of the century, largely because of the contribution it made to ending the practice of lynching. And it all came about because of a photo. Conservative estimates of how many African Americans were murdered by lynching range from the official total of 4,084 up to several thousand more, especially when the numbers killed by capital punishment after kangaroo court trials are factored in. Hundreds of African Americans accused of no serious crime were nonetheless lynched for myriads of offences, including speaking disrespectfully, refusing to step off the sidewalk, using profane language, using an improper title for a white person, suing a white man, arguing with a white man, bumping into a white woman, insulting a white person, and other social grievances. African Americans living in the South during this era were terrorized by the knowledge that they could be lynched if they intentionally or accidentally violated any social mores defined by any white person. Examples are plentiful. Today, there is a memorial garden for the victims of such lynchings in Montgomery, Alabama. On display are the names of known lynching victims, selected photos of lynchings used at the time of their production to strike terror into the hearts of African Americans, and bronze statues depicting the hardship African American slaves endured. Lynching was eventually outlawed in the United States in 1950. The 1930 photograph, the Abel Meeropol poem, and the Billie Holiday song each played a pivotal role in bringing it to an end. William Wilberforce campaigned tirelessly to end slavery in England. Initially, he used argument and reason. This persuaded some, but not most. He then got visual in his argumentation against slavery. Perhaps the most dramatic image that Wilberforce presented was the Madagascar, a slave ship.
Gentlemen, would you stop the music, please? Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I hope you have enjoyed our little tour of the estuary. But now our sojourn is almost over, I have a confession to make. This trip wasn't purely arranged to reward those MPs who have supported me in the past year, nor am I the only sponsor.
What is he doing up there?
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a slave ship, the Madagascar. It has just returned from the Indies, where it delivered 200 men, women, and children to Jamaica. When it left Africa, there were 600 on board. The rest died of disease or despair. That smell is the smell of death. Slow, painful death. Breathe it in. Breathe it deeply. Take those handkerchiefs away from your noses. There now. Remember that smell. Remember the Madagascar. Remember that God made men equal.
It's not that Wilberforce abandoned reason. The primary reason he offered was that all people are equally human and each bear the Imago Dei, the image of God. It's that he supplemented it with images. This included eyewitness accounts from freed African slaves, reports from investigative journalists who travelled on slave ships, and direct evidence of inhumane treatment from former slaves. This was all countered by unreasonable arguments from those with commercial interests in the slave trade, including black people are not actually human. Slavery is actually an act of kindness for these people. Black people may be human, but they are not equally human to the white person. Black people are developmentally and intellectually inferior to white people. Therefore, slavery is doing them a favour. White people have an inherent, inalienable right as truly free people to own a black slave. Wilberforce persisted with his campaign during his political career, which spanned 1791 to 1826. 3 days before his death, the British Parliament outlawed slavery on July 26, 1833. Reason plus complementary images plus persistence is still the formula for changing culture and conquering growing evil and injustice in any society. Today, we are faced with what is arguably the most tragic era of human rights abuses ever. Its victims far outnumber the fatalities of holocausts, wars, or even genocides. The insidiousness of this mass tragedy is that its victims are almost never seen or even acknowledged. I'm referring to the prevalence of abortion. According to one recent journal publication, a quarter of all pregnancies in Australia are aborted. It is estimated that there are at least 70,000 abortions each year in Australia. That means on average 191 unwanted pre-born babies are killed every day in Australia. In the United States, with a population 13 times that of Australia, on average 2,500 abortions occur every day. Many of the arguments put forward to condone abortion sound eerily like those used to justify slavery of Africans around Wilberforce's time. This is a point which Rebecca Dyer makes in her article, The Social Parallels of the America That Enslaved Blacks and the America That Kills Unborn Babies. She says, "It helps to dull the conscience so that evil can be perversely twisted into something that is seen as beneficial for society by so many people. Slaveholders argued that the institution of slavery benefited the slave because it spared him from something worse. They masked their evil by saying they wanted to prevent the slave from possessing something he or she was not equipped to handle, freedom." I'm sure you've heard the statement, "Every child a wanted child." Abortion advocates claim that we need to spare children from pain, poverty, and medical challenges in the future, so we should end their lives by abortion. They say we should not allow an unwanted child to be born. Ending their lives is benefiting the child, women, and society because it is supposedly preventing harm in the future that would be too difficult and burdensome to bear. History has repeated itself. Slavery advocates argued that blacks were intellectually and physically inferior to whites. Now some argue that the fetus is not valuable because it cannot function intellectually or mentally on the same level as another human being. As for the physical aspect, if you are small, dependent, and less developed, then you are inferior in this country. There is no doubt among embryologists that a human embryo is a human person. Our humanity is not dependent upon our size, level of development, environment, or dependency level, which forms the acronym SLED. While this is a reasonable argument, it doesn't persuade everyone. This is why supplementing this argument with appropriate images makes this reasoning even more compelling. Abortion campaigners often wave placards with slogans like, "My body, my rights." It presents aborting a baby as being morally equivalent to extracting a tooth. But how would most of these abortion advocates respond to viewing both an extracted tooth and images of the aborted from 11 weeks to third trimester side by side? Would they still consider that a tooth and an aborted baby are of the same intrinsic worth? Dr. Megan Best, a research fellow at Sydney University who specialises in the ethics of end-of-life issues, states with grave concern, Abortion has become so common in our society that what is involved is rarely discussed. Not only is what is involved not being discussed, it is not being seen either. Scott Klusendorf of the Life Training Institute argues that the case for protecting the unborn must be a complement of both reason and images. In his experience, people often dismiss the reasons for the humanity of the unborn until they view images of aborted fetuses. This is the visual vocabulary missing in this discussion we are not having as a society. We are not against women or their rights, but no one has the right to unjustly take the life of an innocent human being, regardless of their size, even if it is just a few millimetres, or their level of development, a baby's heart begins beating from 5 weeks after conception, or their environment, even if it is a womb, or their dependency level, including being attached to a placenta for 9 months. If you're up to it, here is the link to view what is missing in this discussion. It is difficult to imagine that anyone viewing these images could not be compelled to acknowledge that the practice of abortion is one of the greatest human rights abuses ever committed. The next time you're involved in a discussion with an abortion advocate about this, consider asking for permission to show your protagonist some photos of just what this practice leads to and see if this changes their position.